Come in our study in James to verse 5. As we've gone through these first few verses of James, we've discovered that James is intensely interested in our being able to respond to the stressful situations of our lives in a proper way. I think that in the lives of many of us, we have gotten so used to the concept of salvation by grace through faith alone, and we have been benefited by the abundance of our material possessions and skill of medical science and all of that, until we've gotten it in our minds that yielding to sin isn't really a big problem. So I did it again, confess it, and go on down the road. Well, the problem is, of course, that that's a misunderstanding of the entire issue of grace. And when you stop to think that this entire universe was plunged into the kind of situation that we just heard described for us by one choice. Adam and Eve made one choice, and the entire thing began to unravel. And so we should never, ever take sin lightly. Not at all. And we should make it the same goal that James made it for us when he wrote this letter, to insist that we respond to the difficulties that we face with confidence in the Word of God and in the things that He has said. So in verse 2, we were told to look forward to the time of all joy, which would be just after the judgment seat of Christ. And we were to make our decisions on the basis of what we know would be a joyful thing then, not now. Hazel and I were driving around the other day, and we had the radio on to this station here in the valley, Christian radio. They were dealing with, I guess it was Marriage Day or something, and it was focused on marriage, and they had a lady call in, and she wanted to leave her husband because he was not living up to what she wanted. And the guy asked her if she was in any kind of physically abusive thing. No, he doesn't physically abuse me. But then the whole scenario was, I can't be me if I have to be submissive to this jerk. And, hey, he probably is a jerk. But I got to wondering, too, well, what about you? Here you want him to be responsible, but you're not being. If you claim to be a believer in Jesus, He's called you to the situation that you're in, and He expects you to respond to Him and His Word with confidence and in view of the joy that's to be. You're not supposed to be trying to make life easy now. You're supposed to be trying to decide things on the basis of what will please the Lord and enable Him to reward you in that day. And then in verse 3, it says that we should operate on the basis of this reality that the testing of our faith produces for us endurance. And then in verse 4, we're to permit that process to work, which many, many times does not mean having an instant solution. The whole idea of verse 4, let endurance have its perfect result that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. The whole implication of that is that many, many times God does not intend to make our lives easy and pleasant. His intention is to grow us up. And He knows us so well that He knows we'll never grow up if we don't have to. So He does not intend always to immediately deliver us. So verses 2, 3, and 4 call on us to make some serious decisions about what we're going to do in the situation that we find ourselves in. But one of the biggest problems that all of us run into is, I want to consider all joy. I want to make my decisions based on that. I understand that the testing of my faith produces endurance. I want to permit endurance to have its perfect result. But what do I do? Well, that's what verse 5 addresses. James knew that we would have that question. What do I do? Given the situation, given the fact that there is a decision that I can make that will result in joy after the bema seat, given the fact that trial of my faith does produce endurance and I want endurance to have its perfect work, but what do I do? That's what verse 5 addresses. It says in verse 5, if any of you lacks wisdom, if you don't know what to do, ask of God, who gives to all men generously and without reproach, and it will be given. And I personally believe this is probably the least believed verse in James. There are an enormous number of people who really don't feel like they can ask God for wisdom and He'll give it. But it says He will. Now, I want us to do some thinking about this verse this evening, obviously. But one of the things that I want us to be aware of is what the verse does not say. The verse does not tell us how God will give us wisdom. It just says He will. And I think the reason that He doesn't tell us how God will do it is because God doesn't operate according to a set formula in every individual's situation. Sometimes wisdom comes. I was sitting in a little room in a church building one evening, Saturday night, pretty late. I was a custodian of the church while I was going to seminary back in 73. Making my living by being a custodian, going to seminary during the morning and afternoon, I was having some real significant struggle. And I was sitting in this little room waiting for this seminar to be over so I could clean up for the next day, because the next day was Sunday and I had to have the place ship shape. I wasn't a participant in the seminar. I just wanted them to get through. But the speaker in the ceiling was on, and the guy that was speaking in there said something, one sentence, that changed my whole perspective. One sentence, and it just, like a light came on, and my whole perspective changed. Now, sometimes God does it that way. There are other times when you're involved in His Word, and you're studying His Word, and gradually something begins to dawn. And as you are in it and you're considering it and you're thinking about it, the process of thinking and meditating and studying and praying, all of a sudden it becomes clear over a process. Sometimes God does it that way. Sometimes you'll be wondering, what in the world do I do? And you got, you know, your Christian radio station on and the song comes on and that's the answer. You hear it. And the light comes on, you say, yeah. Sometimes it'll be in conversation with a fellow believer. My point is, verse 5 doesn't limit God to the methods He'll use. It just makes this promise. If you don't know what to do, ask and you'll find out. So let's look at this in that light, having prejudiced your thinking already about the fact that we aren't given any indication of how God will do it, just that He will. I want us to think, first of all, about this whole issue of if you lack wisdom. Who doesn't? When you get to thinking about, there are at least four things that make it almost automatic that we all lack wisdom. Now, not in every circumstance. When we run into a difficult circumstance, sometimes we already know what to do because we faced it before and we learned. So in those situations, we don't lack wisdom. We know what to do, so we just do it. But as God is bringing us along, He's not going to keep letting us face the same old all the time, or we won't grow. So it's kind of like going up a set of stairs. If we respond to God at each step, He'll give us the wisdom we need to take the next step. And typically, if we're walking with Him, the steps are all well within our ability. But I have discovered that if we refuse to take one of those steps, that sooner or later we're going to have to take one, and it's going to be a combination of several, and we're going to have to go about this high in one step just because we wouldn't take the earlier ones. God has a definite intent of bringing us to maturity. He is almost fanatical about that. In fact, He'll kill us over it. If we harden ourselves toward Him sufficiently that there is no more possibility of us growing, He'll take us right out of here. That's what 1 Corinthians 11 says. And in fact, 1 Corinthians 5, where Paul demands that the church turn this person over to Satan for the destruction of his flesh so that his spirit can be saved in the day of the Lord Jesus. It's clear that God considers these issues of growing up in grace and knowledge and learning how to be mature and all that as life and death issues. They're not just take it or leave it issues. But let's consider some of the things that cause us to lack wisdom. First of all, and this is no secret, but life is pretty complex. There are ways of reducing. I mean, you can reduce all the color spectrum down to three colors. John was able to reduce all temptation down to three lusts, or two lusts and one pride issue. But that kind of reductionism is helpful only in a general sense of giving us categories to hang our thoughts on. From the categories, from that reductionism, there are immediately thousands of variations of color. And that's even the word in verse 2, the various trials, that word means multicolored. And the implication is our adversary can mix and mingle things in such a way that if we knew what color he was using, we could do something about it. But we don't even realize what's going on because it's coming at us from another angle. So life is relatively complex, and that makes it necessary for us to have wisdom, and it also points out why sometimes we lack it, because the complexity of life makes it difficult to have all the answers. And then secondly, this is all God has to say. I mean, if you go and get Kittle's Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, which only focuses on Greek, there are about 8 volumes in my library, and there's about this much material. Well, this is all God has to say. But there's enough in here, and it's complex enough that in the final analysis, I think probably if we knew every word that God had given and knew the sense and meaning of every word that God had given in just this one little book, if you want to call it that, we could probably handle about 90% of what life throws at us. We would know how to respond if we knew this book. But there are millions of words in this book. There are hundreds of thousands of sentences and thousands of paragraphs. And we don't know the real significance of many of those passages in the Bible. And even if we study all our lifetime, we have to keep in mind that this is the expression of an infinite mind. God has spoken out of his infinite knowledge to give us this, and so everything that's in here has infinity written all over it. The concepts that are here, they run out forever, and there's no way you can catch them. They're gone. It's just infinite. So with the complexity of life and the complexity of the revelation that God has given, there are two big reasons why there'll come times when we lack wisdom and we need an answer. And then thirdly, not only is life complex and the word complex, but the motivations of our life. The Apostle Paul said to the Corinthians that he wouldn't even judge his own motives. Basically, what he was saying was, given our human condition and our relatively high level of commitment to our own agendas, whether they're hedonism, agendas of pleasure, or materialism, which have to do with agendas of security, or humanism, which have to do with whether I get my way or not, because we have a fairly high focus on being content, being satisfied in those areas, physically, emotionally, and spiritually, we often don't even realize what our motives are for what we're doing or what we're saying. We can be involved in something and think that, yeah, I'm doing this for the glory of the Lord. I'm doing it for that person's sake. I'm trying. And all the while, it may not be that way at all. There may be something in here trying to build something altogether different, and this is just the way I see it doing it. But much of that is below the conscious level of my conscious mind, and it's going on. And Paul just frankly said, I'll wait until the Lord brings everything to light. I don't even judge myself. He said, I'm not conscious of anything against me, but I'm not by that cleared. So motivations are complex and made even more complex by this high level of self-interest that exists in all of us. And then finally, we need wisdom because of those complexities, but we also need wisdom because of the reality that we've emphasized over and over in this study, and that is that we live in a cause and effect universe, and there are real consequences to every decision we make. And when we make a bad decision, there are going to be things that come around. And because that's true, we need to make good decisions. And that means we need to have wisdom. Because it's only wisdom that enables us to make good decisions. So, when he says, if any of you lacks wisdom, he may be saying that kind of with his tongue in his cheek, because I think the assumption is, there's no question about the fact that we will all, at one point or another, need an insight on a situation that we're involved in that we don't have. I was talking to a fella that has a ministry in Sioux City, Iowa, who specializes in taking people who are finally at their wits' end and working through the difficulties that they face to bring them some level of resolution and freedom. What's his book called? Something about recovering surrendered ground. But his whole point is, he has made the statement that if a person will come and stay a week with him and go through the counseling process, that more times than not, there'll be a complete freedom at the end of that week. Whereas other approaches to the problems have told people, well, you're hopeless, you know. There's nothing that can be done for you. But even though he's been doing this, I don't know for how many years he's been involved in this, he just frankly admitted, he said, there'll be times during the week when we just flat won't know what to do next. And you would think, you face everything, don't you, in a counseling ministry like that? Apparently not. Because he said, there are times when we walk up and down the hall saying, Lord, what do we do now? And of course, because verse 5 is in here, they get an answer. But the scriptures assume, verse 5 I really think assumes, that we will come to times when we don't know what to do. So what are we supposed to do when we don't know what to do? Well, according to verse 5, one thing we're supposed to do, it says, let him ask of God. Now, the way that it's stated, my translation reads like this, let him ask of God who gives to all men generously. But in the literal text, when James wrote this, he wrote, let him ask the giving God. The focus is on the characteristic of God as a giver. He gives to all men. I don't know if generously is a good translation or not, but generously without reproach. Let him ask of the giving God. Now, what that means is a couple of things. Number one, the command to ask, let him ask. That word that is translated ask is a word that often has two overtones built right into it. One of them is the overtone of demandingness. It's a word that often is used in the context of making a demand. And the other overtone is a context or an overtone of distance. In other words, this is kind of a formal word where you make a formal demand or you make a formal request. And you're making it within the context of some kind of established relationship, but it's not a close one. Now, some people would say, well, that's kind of scary. Here he's saying demand from God and this distance in the relationship. Well, instead of being scary, I think what that means is that it's applicable to a believer at any level of maturity, from being a brand new born-again child to a relatively mature saint. If he had used a term that implied that you had to have a real sense of how submissive you should be and have a real sense of closeness with God when you do all this, he'd eliminated about two-thirds of us, wouldn't he? He'd been basically saying that you'll get wisdom if you've grown up enough to get it, but that's not the term he used. He seems to imply that he expects the person who's under stress and doesn't know what to do when he turns to God, he almost expects him to almost snap at God. Well, what do you want me to do? There's that kind of demandingness, and you've got to do something here. But I really don't think God's offended by that. I don't think that it bothers God at all for one of his children to want to make the right decision and to be at a point in, what do I do? As long as the rest of the stuff is in place, and we'll be talking about the rest of the stuff as we work our way through it. But it was encouraging to me to discover that closeness of relationship and a certain maturity in submission are not really the issues here. Now, there is an overriding issue that's brought up real clearly in verse 6, but generally speaking, that was raised in verse 1, James, a bondservant. And it's obvious that he's writing to people that he expects have some desire to be a bondservant. So this demandingness and perhaps immaturity does have to have this overriding thing. I want to do what's right. And I can't if I don't know what that is. So the command to ask is a command that really reduces the requirement of maturity and love. It kind of pulls the whole issue of maturity and love. You don't have to be very mature and very loving. That's kind of encouraging. But the second thing that the command has built into it is that you have to have at least some understanding of the character of the God that you're asking. That's why he says, let him ask of the giving God. Because the description that God has in our minds is a necessary foundation for us asking him. If we don't think that he's a giving God, how much chance is there that we're going to ask him for anything? Not much. In desperation, we might, but the teaching of Jesus in the Gospels was that we should pray with a certain degree of confidence. I mean, it's built right into all of his instruction. When you pray, believe that you have what you request and it'll be granted to you. Jesus more or less insisted that we have at least a basic concept of God as a giver, one who responds when we ask. And if we don't have that, then basically what will happen is we won't ask. I was involved in a counseling situation one time with a fellow who was having some problems in a relationship that he was involved in. I just asked him, well, what kind of feedback do you get when you pray about this? Oh, I haven't been praying about it. Well, I know why he wasn't praying about it, because there's too much guilt in what he'd been doing in that relationship. And he didn't want to talk to God about it. But that meant that my counseling was a waste of time too, because if he didn't want to know what God wanted him to do about it, why ask me? I mean, you know, you can get any kind of answer from any place. You don't have to ask me. Well, he might have. We do long for that. And it's really strange. In a lot of stress situations where we're being pressured, that's what verses 2, 3, 4, and so on are about. We're being pressured. Many, many times, we really do just want somebody to tell us what we want to hear. But that's not what's going on in this verse. He commands us to go to God with it in this request mode, but we have to have the understanding that we're dealing with the giving God. Now, this is going to be built a little bit by two words in verse 5 that we are given about the way God gives. He says he gives, and it's translated generously. That's kind of a hard word to translate because it's only used one time in the New Testament, and it's not used a lot of times in other places. But I did find three places in the Septuagint that it was used, and there are some extra-biblical places where it's used. The word basically has the idea of having something that's clear. For example, in the book of 2 Maccabees, the apostate king of Syria had made this regulation that Jews could not observe the Sabbath, they could not offer sacrifices, and they couldn't claim to practice the Jewish religion. And the word "not at all," or "not to claim to be a Jew at all," the "at all" is this word. And the implication is having nothing that's really clearly going to set you apart as a Jew. It was illegal. You could die for it. Well, if that's really the way that word is used in the culture, and James is the only person in the New Testament that used it, then probably what he's saying is that the giving God gives clarity. That there's something specific that he's going to, and you'll know that this is the will of God. And isn't that required anyway? I mean, what's the point of asking God, "What do I do," if you're not going to get a clear answer? And James obviously wants us to believe that if we ask, God will give us a clear answer. And the second thing he tells us is that God will do this without reproach. That word means that he won't do anything to try to humiliate you or shame you because you ask him. And that's kind of encouraging too. Because there have been many times when, well, you should know the answer to that. What's the matter with you? You too stupid to learn? That kind of stuff. If you ask God what he wants you to do, given a pressure situation, and you ask the giving God, and you want to do what he reveals, it will come with both clarity and an absence of upbraiding or humiliation. He's not going to go over all of the things that he could go over to humiliate us. He'll just make it clear. And it says in verse 5 that the giving God gives clearly and without reproach. And if a person asks the giving God, it says at the end of the verse, it will be given to him. Now, I do two things with this verse. When I have a situation that I know is going to color the direction of my life, I pray. And I look for an answer until I find a clear one. But there are other times when I don't want to ask because I don't want to hear. I'm scared of what he might say. And if I don't want to do it, I don't want to hear it. Now, I'm just revealing my depravity to you. It's not a good way to act. It's a real poor concept of God. His will is the best, and he's far wiser and more loving than we'll ever get to be. So I shouldn't be afraid of what he might tell me. But the plain fact is, I am sometimes, and so I don't want to pray. But if I don't know what to do and I don't pray, you know what I'm going to do? Something wrong. It's not going to work right. That's why verse 5 is here. James has already loaded us up in verses 2, 3, and 4 with the requirement that we be committed enough to the will of God to let the process work no matter what it costs us. But he realizes that having loaded us up that way, there is still yet the question, well, what do I do? Because even if the answer is, well, just sit there and do nothing, that's still something I got to decide. So we have to have answers. And the verse says that God will give them clearly and without humiliating us. Now, I said this is probably the least believed verse in the book of James because of the number of people who claim to be the children of God who walk around wondering, you know, what's life all about? I don't know why I'm doing it. And there's just a fog and awe and complaining about all this stuff. I don't think that verse 5 allows for that. I think that verse 5 says, if you're committed to the will of God, you want to make decisions that are going to result in joy in that day, and you know that the process you're going through is for your good, You're committed to that. And you're going to let it work so that you can become what you should be. And you want to know what God wants you to do, all you got to do is ask. Now, that sets us up with some expectations, like, well, how long do I have to wait for this clear answer? Well, there's no answer to that. You will know what you have to do before you have to choose, before you have to make the decision, but you may not know until just before you have to make it. God is not above giving you an answer 3 weeks before you need it, but he's also not above waiting until the 20th day of that 3 weeks to give you the answer you need. I mean, the Bible gives that whole range of possibilities. The only thing we're sure of is that the promise that he will give it will be timely. You'll know what you have to do before you have to decide. And so verse 5, even though it's probably one of the least believed verses in the book of James, is perhaps one of the most encouraging. It's a point-blank promise. If you ask, he'll give. It has to do with wisdom in a stress situation, but if you ask in a stress situation, what do I do? He'll show you. Okay? We're about out of time. We're about out of verse. But this is a you-can-bank-on-it kind of commitment. By God, you'll have it. Okay, are there any questions or comments you want to make before we wind this up?